This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Good morning to you all this morning. It's a privilege to be here again, and I really enjoyed the opening comments. Completely and sufficiently introduced the topic of the day. Working with high-need students. I have a verse for you this morning, a verse that was given to me this morning, and it really filled a need in my life, and so I share it with you, Isaiah 41, verse 10. Don't be afraid, for I am with you. Don't be frightened, for I am your God. I strengthen you, yes, I help you. Yes, I uphold you with my saving right hand. It was put very well. We have high-need students, we are high-needs teachers, and we have an all-sufficient God. He can help us in times of trouble. Today we're looking at those students in our classrooms that have special needs apart from learning disabilities, although sometimes that's affected. And when you have a child that has trouble learning, you might want to check in, dig a little deeper, look for a root cause, and find out why. Because if we can fix the situation or meet the need that's causing the problem, well, we've just fixed two problems, or maybe more than that. The other thing I'd like to say, just in opening here, is something that I believe. And that is that the work that we do and the accomplishments that we have are through Christ, and we will not see them completely until we're on the other side. So don't give up. Never give up. Because we don't know, and we can't possibly see what all God is doing through us. So often we miss opportunities because they come to us disguised in problems. And I believe that as well, that problems are nothing more than great opportunities. You think about that. Any problem has big time opportunities wrapped in it. You just have to find them. Someone said, if there's a child in your Sunday school class, and I would say in your classroom, that's climbing the walls, pay him some respect. He's probably your next pastor. Just because he's giving you trouble today doesn't mean that he won't grow up. I've asked that they dim the lights because we're going to be looking at a lot of pictures today. I brought some pictures of the people that I am with and some of the students in our school. And I want to tell you some stories today as we go along and look at working with high-need students. 1 Corinthians 13, 11 to 13 says, when I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. And I thought about what I just told you. That child that's causing you trouble today will grow up. And he'll remember more how you made him feel than maybe what you taught him. And he's going to remember those things that you did for him and the lessons, the life lessons. You see, the greatest lessons that we learn in school are the ones we learn about ourselves. It goes on to say that I became a man and I put away childish things. Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. That's why I believe that we're going to see everything. We're going to see fully. And we're going to see clearly what God did, or maybe what God wanted to do through us. But we're going to have to wait, and we're going to have to trust and see through our spiritual eyes, see things that we can't see with our physical eyes. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. Now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity. I've taken those three words, and that's on your papers, the 3 points that I'd like to look at today with working with high needs students: faith, hope, and charity. Going back to the talk yesterday, people are like houses. Well, children are like houses too. But they're little people, they're houses under construction. And their design and their structure and the architecture is still changeable. They're still moldable. They're not there yet. And you, as a Christian teacher, have a whole lot to do with how that's going to turn out at the end. So I'd like to just encourage you to take that responsibility seriously and realize the potential. And I would say that we can't possibly realize the full potential that we have, because there's a lot there. It's a lot. I'd like to look at these three things: faith, hope, and charity. And remember the goals that we also looked at yesterday. We need to prepare children for life. You know, we can work on spelling, and I think that's really important. A child should learn to read well and write neatly and write well. They're going to need that in life. My aunt studied to be a teacher. She was in teacher's college in Canada. And they said to her early on in her training, they said, either better your handwriting or change professions. A teacher needs good handwriting. So maybe you're preparing a teacher. Maybe you're preparing a fireman. Maybe you're preparing an evangelist. And I think reading and writing and math and writing neatly are very important. But don't stress too much on that. Remember, you're preparing them for life. They're going to grow up, and they're going to be the leaders of the future. They're going to carry a part of us with them. I heard a great workshop yesterday about being ourselves. And as we go down through these things, remember that if you have them, that's probably your best chance at passing them on. I thought of the poem, "I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather you walk with me than merely point the way. The eye is a more ready pupil than ever was the ear. Good advice is often confusing, but example is always clear." We should suit the learning to them as an individual. We talked about that. And we should help parents achieve the goals they have for their children. And I'm sure there's a lot of other goals. And you have other goals. And it's good to have goals. Let's look at faith. Wasn't planning on that one. That's a picture of our school. I started working with a school that already existed in Guatemala about 10 years ago. In 2004 was the first year that I began to work. 2003, there were 17 students in this school. And it was a Christian school designed for children from the local church. I also work with that church. But there were some neighboring families that wanted to send their children there And so they had made a few exceptions. There were about two or three non-church families there. And there were other families from the community that wanted to send their children, but they were always denied because it was a small school and there wasn't room. And it didn't seem fair to me that some parents really wanted to send their children there, but because they didn't have the right connection or whatever, they couldn't send their children. I also felt at the same time, and I don't know really where I got this, but the town I live in Guatemala has 15 other evangelical churches besides the Mennonite church. And I sensed that the people in the village, the people in our town, weren't looking for another church. They had enough options. They had lots of churches. But it seemed to me like what they really needed was a good education, a good education option. We were the first private school that opened in our town. And so we work with the government. We are certified with the government and therefore can give legal certification. When a student passes his grade 6 exams, he's given a diploma that's recognized. He can go to any school from there. The director that was working with the school when I got there in 2003 said, you know, my advice for you would be to just close the school. There's no future here. It's been getting less and less. The interest is waning. It's hard to get teachers. There were 21 students last year, and this year there's 17. I'm guessing there's going to be about 15 or 13 the next year. I said, you know, I don't see that. I don't agree. I see something else. I think we're given a lot of gifts. I think we can do a lot of things that aren't happening here. And I think we can teach those students how to raise their hand. They don't just have to talk. School doesn't have to be chaos. It doesn't have to be a visit to the local zoo. We can do better than that. Well, he said, you can try. I don't think it's going to work here. I opened the doors. I told some of the people that had been wanting to send their children there for a number of years. They said, we're open. If you're in, we're in. But you probably don't want to send your students here because we're going to be really strict. And I had a list of rules. And I had a vision, mission statement, and some things that they had to do and be willing to do as families and parents. Now, that list has changed in the last 10 years a whole lot. And I would just throw this in for whatever it's worth. When you start something, it doesn't look at all like it will in 10 years. So be okay with that. And my encouragement would be, get started. Go to it. That year we had 30 students. The next year we had 75. And then it was 90. And since then it's been around 100, between 100 and 130. We started seeing a need. You see, in Guatemala, the school goes by different levels. Grades 1 to 6 is considered primary. And there's a certain certification for teachers that they need to have to legally operate for teaching students from grades 1 to 6. And then there's the intermediate level, grades 7, 8, and 9. And you need other certification to be a teacher in that level. And then grade 10, 11, and 12, those 3 years are not high school like we know them in the States or in Canada, but rather the students can pick an area of study. So they can pick a general area of study, which gets them into university. But they could also choose accounting and be a certified accountant after 12 years. They could choose nursing and become a nurse. They could choose teaching and become a teacher. And so I started encouraging some of the young people from church to get into groups and go through and become teachers, to be able to teach in our school. The teaching thing just changed this past year. It's now a university level course. And so we lost our window of opportunity for pushing some of these Christian teachers through in the 12 years. They're going to now have to study the general studies option and then go on to university. A number of years ago, we saw a trend. See, we only had grades 1 to 6, and that's what you see up here. I think this is probably grade 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 6, or 3 to 6. I was looking at it this morning, and I can't quite remember. But a couple years ago, we felt a burden for these students that leave our school at grade 6 and go to other public schools. There are students age 12 to 14, and in Guatemala, that's where students really are battling with life issues. That's where they're really deciding. I would guess that in our culture here in the U.S. and Canada, it's a little older than that, probably 14, 15, 16. I don't know what you think. You can share with me later. But we started praying about it and asked God to move the mountains. And this past year, we added grade 7 and 8 to our school. And next year, we hope to have grade 9. It takes a lot of faith. It takes a lot of dreaming. And it also takes a lot of work. But more than anything, I think it takes trust in God. We have a Christian school, supposedly, in Guatemala. You have a Christian school. This is a concept that I heard recently, and I really liked it. You know, we have Christian schools. We have Christian teachers. We even have Christian textbooks. But never forget, the students aren't Christians until they give their hearts fully to Jesus Christ. And so you're going to have to watch for that. And that's part of this discussion. Faith. We need to teach students to believe the Bible. Because of the certification thing, I'm going to university. It's a public state university. And there are so many discussions there that we just wouldn't have to have if we just go back to the Bible. There is so much time wasted discussing fluff, a bunch of nothing, because people don't believe the Word of God. So we need to believe the Bible. We need to teach our students to believe the Bible. We need to teach them to have faith. Another concept that I heard recently that really struck me is that children deem important those things that we make them do. Think about school for a minute. You make them keep their pencil sharp in math class, or I assume you do. You make them sit down in a desk and listen, because that's important. But if we don't make them learn their memory work, we say, well, he has trouble memorizing. It's possible. But he's going to interpret it as it's really not that important. In our situation, I realize you don't face this, but I'm coming to the realization that we're going to have to make some of these children go to church. Because that's important. And it seems strange that we would make children go to church. But if we don't make them do it, they're going to think that it's really not important. We need to show faith. The best way to show faith is have some. Can you trust God for everything that you face? Is God big enough to solve all of your problems? The big ones and the small ones. We need to pray for our students. Pray for them. If I'm having trouble with a student, one of my students, I either stay after school when they're all gone and I sit in his desk or her desk and I think about them for a while. And then I ask God to help them, to change them, and to help me to know how to help them. There is something about sitting in their desk that just gives you a different perspective. And if you can take it one further, if you can get yourself invited over for supper, by all means do it. Go to their house. You know, it's one way, we'll talk about this later possibly, it's one way of showing love. It's showing that you care. Now, I don't know if you can invite yourself over or not to your students' families' places, but if you can, get an invitation over there. You're going to learn so much about little Johnny from mom and dad and how mom and dad act and what the living room looks like and what his bedroom looks like. Have him take you around. Figure out what is important to him. And it's going to give you a brand new perspective. I pray for my students. I teach them to pray. I think that's really important. Put them in touch with the greatest force there is in the universe. And teach them how to read and learn from that great source. I got a call late one night. It was from a student I had had years before. His name was Bidon. He spent a lot of time sitting on our couch. I don't know what he really did there. He'd just show up and he'd sometimes be there for lunch. And he'd talk but I just remember him mostly sitting on the couch. And I'd see him at school. See, his dad had walked out on his mom and left her all alone with four boys. Bidon was a twin. His younger twin, by a few minutes, was good at school. He was good at sports. He was a success in life. And Bidon just plain wasn't. He was 14 when he was in grade 5. And he called me years later. It was late at night. He said, "Stephen?" I said, "Yes. Is it Bidon?" He said, "Yeah, this is Bidon." I said, "What can I do for you?" He said, "I have to get together with you. Can you come and find me?" I said, "Sure, tell me where you are. I'll find you." He told me where he was. I said, "What's wrong? You sound terrible." He said, "I just ran over a little girl, and I killed her. And I need you to come and pray for me, because I'm not doing okay." I said, "I'll be right up." But it spoke volumes to me. Why did he call me? He goes to another church in town. He has his own pastor. But I sat with him when the police came, when the judge came, not the judge, the lawyer came. See, in Guatemala, if you kill somebody with a vehicle, you're just as guilty as if you would have done it with a gun. And so he was in big trouble. But Bidon knew where to go. He wasn't maybe sure how to go by himself, but he knew that God could bring him peace that he needed. God could give him the strength to face his situation. Prove to them that God is big. There is nothing too little or too great to pray about, not to pray about. I tried to figure out how to write that, and I don't know how to write it, but the idea is that we can pray about anything. And I thought about selbing. You see, we don't allow jewelry at our school. No rings, no necklaces, just because it causes lots of problems. And we are, after all, a Christian school. It's something that the Guatemalans really like to wear. And one day, this little boy came to me. This was years ago, in the first years, probably the year that we had 30 students. He came to me and he said, "Brother Stephen," that's what they call me. Even the guys that wear the big guns, they call me Brother Stephen too, because that's my name in town. He said, I don't know how to say this, but I lost my ring. I said, your ring? Yeah, he said, I brought my ring to school today, and I know I shouldn't have. But they were out at recess time, and it was too tight, so he took it off, and he put it on the bench. And when they were done playing, they had their snack and went back to class, and now it's not on the bench. And you know, for a minute, I thought of saying, that's why you shouldn't bring rings to school. But I said, that's terrible. I said, I'm sure it'll be here somewhere. Maybe we'll go over and check in the office. Maybe somebody found it and handed it in. He said, oh, he doesn't think so, because it's a gold ring. And he is going to catch it if he goes home without it. I said, really? Oh, yeah. He said, I won't be at school tomorrow if I don't find my ring. I said, okay, well, let's pray about it. God can see your ring. God knows where your ring is. And I'm thinking, Stephen, you're crazy. God can see your ring, and so it's not a big thing for him. He can show us where it is. And we knelt down there in the schoolyard, and we prayed. And I said, God, you see Selbing's ring. Now help us see it. And he prayed, because I thought it was a good time to teach him how to pray. And we got up, and I said, like, okay, so it was on the bench here. What would have happened if somebody would have sat on it? You know, maybe they would have carried it away or something. We started looking, and here we found it. 30 seconds later, it was pushed down into the mud. He had combed the area. He hadn't been able to find it. You know, I don't think Selbing will ever forget that God is big. And he's really, really interested in those tiny little parts of our life. We need to give our students hope. I read a poem yesterday. For some of you, it's the second round. Teachers, molders of dreams. Every student, every child has a dream, and you can mold that dream. And that's a big deal. That's a big responsibility. The poem goes like this. It's written by Clark Mullenhoff. Teachers, you are the molders of their dreams. The gods, that's with a little g, the gods who build or crush their young beliefs of right or wrong. You are the spark that sets aflame the poet's hand or lights the flame of some great singer's song. You are the god of the young, the very young. You are the guardian of a million dreams. Your every smile or frown can heal or pierce a heart. You are 100 lives, 1,000 lives, yours the pride of loving them, and the sorrow too. Your patient work, your touch, make you the gods of hope, who fill their souls with dreams to make those dreams come true. How do we give them hope? I think we need to encourage them. We need to encourage growth. You know, a lot of children are used to people telling them, you're no good. You'll never succeed. You'll never make it. We have to change that. We need to recognize effort. I'd like to tell you a little story about something that I learned in grade 3. You see, the teacher had left an art assignment. We were supposed to draw and color our house. I mean, how easy is that? She gave us each a piece of paper. You know, thinking back, I wonder if she had been busy the night before. Well, I took out my crayons and my pencil and my eraser, and I had a house. I drop-kicked a house onto that page. and I colored it. And it looked like my house. My house was blue. And I colored my house blue. And my house had a chimney. And I drew smoke coming out of the chimney. And there were clouds in the sky. And there were birds. And there was a big sun with a smiley face. And in front of the house, there were flower beds, like my mom had planted there. And I turned in my paper. And then I got out my library book. And I started to read. And I kind of looked out of the corner of my eye at my friend Philip. He had his ruler. He was measuring. He was drawing straight lines. Oh, but then that one was crooked, so he'd erase it. By the end of art class, he hadn't even gotten to the crayon part. And his paper was a mess. Eraser smudges, creases where he had leaned his arm on it. And I saw his paper go into his backpack. He was going to have to finish it at home. I had gotten mine done with time to spare. Too bad they didn't let me help him. The next day, I guess the artwork came back. We went home for the weekend, and on Monday morning, that artwork was up on the bulletin board. And I went over to look at my picture. And then I saw Phillip's. It looked terrible. And then I saw the teacher had written on his paper A. And I'm like, yeah, how much did I get? I'm sure I got an A plus. I went over and I looked. It was a B. And being the shy, timid child I've always been, I went over and I addressed the teacher. I said, we've got a problem here. A casual observer could see that my picture's better. We need to do some grade adjusting. She said, you know, Stephen, your picture's really nice. But I know that if you'd take a bit of effort, it could be so much better. You could have done a much better job. And she said, you know, Philip's picture doesn't look as nice as yours, but he tried a lot harder. I have never forgotten that. Believe in them. You know, we read in the Bible about Paul and Barnabas. Who was the leader? Thank you. You know what? I realized that recently. I didn't know that before. See, I always thought of Paul and Barnabas. Paul, the leader, Paul, the apostle Paul. And Barnabas got to go along. How many of you would have liked to have been Barnabas? I'd sign up for Barnabas any day. That would be great. To go on a missionary journey with the Apostle Paul. But you know, it was Barnabas, like he said, that gave Paul the chance. When somebody needed to vouch for Paul, it was Barnabas that said, you know, give him a chance. I believe in him. I think it's okay. I don't think this is a trap. That to me is amazing. Am I willing to take that chance? Am I willing to believe? Know that God can. God can do things that you can't even imagine. And God wants to do those things in people's lives. Remember, your labor is not in vain. And I'd like to tell you a little story. We'll skip this one. The girl in the middle, her name is Marjorie. She came to our school when she was 10. She had been in grade one three times, and she still couldn't read. And she thought she was dumb. She thought that she couldn't. She was convinced that she was a loser. Her parents brought her and said, you know, we've been hearing some things. We don't know if we can afford the tuition here, but we're going to try it for a year. And I said, well, I think we'll be all right. Marjorie started studying, and she learned to read, and she's still there. In fact, when we added on the grade 7 and 8, I called her dad and I said, do you think Marjorie will be coming? He said, you know, I think you should add a career too, 10, 11, and 12. Doesn't matter what it is, Marjorie will study it. He's convinced. You see, she went home after a couple weeks of being at our school, and she was singing some songs, some little Christian songs. And she would say her verses to her dad that she had learned in memory class. And one day, he said to his wife, "You know, wife, we're going to go to church. You pick a church, but we're going to go on Sunday." And she couldn't figure out what had come over him. She said, "You've got to be kidding. I've been begging you to go to church for years." He said, "Well, my little girl, she's way out ahead of me. She knows more about God than I do, and we're not going to tolerate that. So we're going to go to church." They picked the most liberal evangelical church in town, and that's where they went to church. But he found God. He quit his job. You see, he was a bodyguard. And he put his gun in a drawer, and he left it there. His wife says that he doesn't have the temper he used to. He used to get really angry. He wouldn't go anywhere with his gun, without his gun. In fact, he wouldn't stand here like I'm standing. He always had his back against the wall. He'd never let anyone get behind him. One day he was driving down the road and he got pulled over in a police check. This was just a little while ago. And the policeman asked him for his license, so he was digging through his wallet for his license, and he pulled a card out. It was his gun registration, his permit to carry a firearm. And the police said, "Oh, you have a gun? You have a weapon?" He said, "Yeah, actually, but I'm not carrying it. This one. I have another weapon now." And he pulled his Bible off his dash. He takes his girl to church. She no longer knows more about God than he does. God will do things that you think is impossible. Whoops, we're going the wrong way. The greatest of these is charity. What does love look like? I'd like you to take a minute and jot down some things that a friend could do for you to show love. In the little box there, what could a friend do to show love or that he or she cares about you? We're running out of time here, so I'm just going to mention that there is a book that talks about the five love languages. The five love languages are words of affirmation, acts of service, quality time, gifts, and physical touch. Once again, it's one of those groupings that I don't think is completely general. It can't be applied, you know, black and white, but it gives us an idea of different ways that we can show love. And in the book, it brings out that different people receive love differently. And it made a whole lot of sense to me, because I have a brother that I've had trouble understanding. And he would always give me a very nice gift for my birthday. And I could never figure it out. I thought, you know, if he likes me so much, why doesn't he skip the gift on the birthday? And why doesn't he help me fix my bike? Now, if some of you have studied that, you know something about me, and you know something about my brother. And if you've never heard of it, I'd encourage you to look at it. You can probably, if you filled out the list, have an idea of how you tend to receive or show love. All of your students are going to tend to receive and show love differently. And keep that in mind. Study them. Study the five love languages. Apply it. Show them love. Love that they can understand. Love that they can receive. Part of love is acceptance. Accept them how they are, where they are, and who they are. Remember, they're a house that's under construction. You can change who they are, but accept them first. Tell them that it's okay to be just like they are. And then encourage growth, encourage change in the right way. A big part of love is security. That's something that a lot of the children that we work with in our school don't have. Our school starts at 7 o'clock in the morning, and there are students that are lined up at the front gate at 6. And I often get to school about that time, and I look at that group, and I think, you know, that's our key focal group. Those are the people that we need to focus on, because they know full well they can't get inside that gate until 20 to 7. That gate does not open to them. Teachers come and go, and we get the day, you know, prepared, but they're not allowed in until 20 to 7. They stand at the gate for 40 minutes at 6 o'clock in the morning. Why? Because school is a much more secure place to them than home is. Some of you had that figured out already. I could see it. Another part of love is discipline. And you know that. And there are some really good workshops about that, and I'd encourage you to take them. And so I don't think I'll go into that. We're running out of time. We can express love in so many ways. I'd like to read the poem to you that's over on the side of your worksheet. Imagine one of those high needs students that you've had saying this poem to you. Because I think in many ways, if you're a good teacher, that's what they're saying. Love by Ray Croft. I love you not only for what you are, but for what I am when I am with you. I love you not only for what you have made of yourself, but for what you are making of me. I love you for the part of me that you bring out. I love you for putting your hand into my heaped up heart and passing over all the foolish weak things that you can't help dimly seeing there, and for drawing out into the light all the beautiful belongings that no one else had looked quite far enough to find. I love you because you are helping me to make of the lumber of my life not a tavern, but a temple. Out of the works of my everyday, not a reproach, but a song. High needs children often have a special capacity to love. High needs children often have a special capacity to care for those less fortunate. I'd like to read a story entitled Sister Rita Marine and Mom. Sister Rita Marine thought I was mentally deficient. That's what she told my parents in her blunt, matter-of-fact way. Mr. and Mrs. Brown, she said, peering at them through slanted, pink-framed sun eyeglasses. It's the end of the first quarter of school, and Kathy can't read. Something's very wrong with her. She looked away, embarrassed. I think you know what I mean. There was a stunned silence in the first grade classroom, and then my mother was suddenly overwhelmed with tears. Dad snapped to attention. Nobody, not even a nun, was permitted to make my mother cry. And not one, not even a nun, should dare to suggest that one of his children was even remotely less than perfect. Sister Rita Marine, he said, I think there's something very wrong with the teacher. It still shocks me to the end of my toes that Dad would talk to a sister like that. Dad was as good a Catholic as they come, but he was very angry. I didn't hear about this story until years later, but looking back, it explains a lot. Sister Rita Marine never did warm up to me. How could she? Dad had done the unthinkable. He had been disrespectful to a nun. According to tradition, he and all his offspring would burn in hell. I don't know why I couldn't read. That first day of first grade, I walked the half block to school with lofty ambitions and fully expected to come home reading vast volumes. But I had attended a different kindergarten across town. All the other first graders at my new Catholic school seemed to have a jump on me. After the first week, Sister sent me with a copy of Dick and Jane to sit by the radiator with group three, the loser group. We all knew it. We were the handful of stupid kids who were relegated to the back of the room so that Sister Rita Marine could get on with the real business of teaching. I'd leaf through Dick and Jane and stare at the big, vibrant pictures. Jane and her little sister Sally fascinated me. They wore different color-coordinated outfits every day. Dresses, hair ribbons, socks, they all matched. I longed to know them. They looked like such happy little girls. After that fateful parent-teacher conference, Sister Rita Marine ignored me completely. But it didn't matter. Mom decided to take matters into her own hands. One afternoon, I came home after school to see flashcards lined up across the back of the couch in the den. "Today," Mom announced, "you're learning to read." We started with consonants. Then she taught me the sounds of all the vowels. I remember the first word I ever read, cat. So much like my own name. I stared in wonder at Mom. She smiled her beautiful smile and said, "See, that's all there is to it." After that, I sounded out every single word I could find on street signs, cereal boxes, and toothpaste tubes. Then one magical day, Mom walked me over to the library at Montview and Claremont, and I walked out with five books and a library card of my own. Nothing before or since has ever given me such satisfaction. Learning to read simply changed my whole world. In Sister Rita Marine's class, I was still sitting by the radiator. By now, I had become intimately acquainted with Dick, Jane, Sally, Spot, Puff, and the whole cast of characters. On my own, I read the stories of their lives. I was too absorbed to be unhappy. One day, however, Sister called Group 3 to the front. This was a surprise. Our little group roused itself and trooped to the front of the room. "Open your books," Sister Rita Marine ordered us. "Read, Kathy." She fixed me with her steely, pale blue eyes. So I read. Sister forgot to tell me to stop. I read three pages before I finally took a breath and looked up. Every kid in the room was staring at me in astonishment. It hit me in that instant. I was the best reader in the class. I smiled up at Sister Rita Marine. She was astounded. Suddenly, she snapped her mouth shut. "Well," she cleared her throat. "Aren't you something?" she said primly. That was all. I have been a teacher for more than 30 years now, but it was a long time before I really understood why I even wanted to teach. It was because of first grade. In the first grade, I learned the greatest lesson of my life. For that, I'm grateful to Sister Rita Marine. She taught me that a teacher's smallest touch, word, or look can be so powerful that it can change the entire way a child thinks about herself. My mom taught me this very same thing. God bless you all, and especially you first grade teachers.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.